So, in verse 117, which describes the whole goal is samadhi. It's this total absorption in consciousness, fixed without fluctuations. And when they say there's with support, somehow it's done through the mind, and somehow or other the mind dissolves, and then you're abiding in your own nature, whatever. That, so they, you know, it says that you, some forget samadhi, which it's with some kind of support. It's an it goes in different absorptions. Absorption with physical awareness, absorption with subtle awareness, absorption with bliss, absorption of the sense of I. They're signposts of experience people have had, and they're hard to put in English or Sanskrit, really. But it just means that meditation comes in a deeper and deeper level. And in my own meditations, I have that experience. You go from meditating on objects to actually feeling your own self and awareness. And so again, for those of you who are interested, then you can it says the other samadhi, which is this without support, is preceded by cultivating the determination to terminate all thoughts. So it's kind of so longer is no object aware, it becomes subject aware. It becomes aware just of itself. And then it mentions here, there's 118, Visram Pratyaya. It's a terminator thought. That's all this stuff. This is one thought that's terminating all other thoughts. Again, it's one conception of perfection, another conception of perfection in my tradition, that perfection does have thoughts, conceptions, ideas, but they're spiritual. So it's a different way. We're going to go on. There's very technical verses here. Now, 123. Or Ishvara Pranidhanat Va. Or this previously mentioned state is attainable, these samadhis, from devotion to the Lord. Now, it's giving this as an option. But actually, this is interesting. I heard this recently. You know, the yoga tradition in the West comes from Krishnanamacharya. He's the one. And then from him, there's Patabi Joyce. And there's Iyengar. That student of his, A.G. Mohan, which was also, he's a very brahminical scholar, he actually said, without this, it's very hard to achieve perfection. Because without awareness of something greater than yourself, it's very difficult to get rid of the ego. But it says va, or, so it's an option, because you have to understand, whatever Patanjali's theistic views are, he has the integrity that he's dealing with a particular system and he's going to explain it according to the system. So he's not describing particularly, in one sense, a theistic conception as he's describing a psychosomatic technique of the mind. But as you'll see in the Yoga Sutras, his theistic preferences become kind of obvious, or that he has a theistic preference. Actually, this is the verse I read to thee. Those Christian students. I mean, but I'd have to say, in sense, they were conservative in the sense that a kind of economic conservatives, not social conservatives. You know, they didn't like big government, you know. The guy told me, you know, when I was young, I took my shotgun to school. And the principal said, "Graham, do you have your ammunition unloaded?" He said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Okay, keep that in your locker." So, and he said, I don't want to tell what he said, but, and he said, "Well, you know, the real problem is the morality. We would just, you know, whatever we do, hunt, whatever." Didn't understand that point. But what he said, when they were social conservatives, they weren't social conservatives. You know, there's one thing to say, okay, that's your view of big government, you know, but everyone else starved. But they were altruistic. These people had huge charities for people. So they had a kind of conception that the government shouldn't do it, whether you agree, I don't agree or disagree, but at least, well, okay, the government shouldn't do it, let the people starve on the street. At least they had altruistic charities, orphanages in Africa for thousands of people, and try, you know, helping people like that. But this is one of the verses I read. I'll read some of it. Why? But great misconception about Indian spiritual thought is that it doesn't have a conception of a personal God. That view is a very, in other words, this one conception of the soul that in perfection you realize that individuality is an illusion, and then you kind of, everything becomes one, and there's no distinction at all. That's a very much a minority view in Indian, of those six schools of thought, except practically speaking for one division of one school, they all believe in the eternal individuality of the soul, including yoga. They believe that in perfection, you remain an individual. And that there is a supreme individual. So yoga is a theistic conception. Although it doesn't talk at all about what the relationship of that soul is to God or the supreme in perfection. Now the term Ishvara itself is a generic term accepted for God. That's what Ishvara. Isha means to control. Ishvara is God. And so he's saying, or you can meditate on God. And what you have to do is the Yoga Sutras, is you have to understand the context of what it's speaking. When they say Ishvara, in those times, that's what it's referred. He doesn't give a particular name of a deity, right? A particular personalized deity, although there's indications that probably he was a devotee of Vishnu or Krishna or Shiva. There's a lot of indications like that. But he's saying Ishvara. It's the most generic term for God. Okay? So, and one of George Feuerstein, who's a he notes, the popular academic notion that the conception of God was interpolated into classical yoga is completely unfounded. So, of the six schools, of traditional thought that stem from this period, five, Nyaya, Visheshika, Vedanta, Yoga, and Sankhya, were or became theistic. So most of the schools were theistic. And this term Ishvara, it is the term preferred in philosophical discourse concerning the existence of a personal God. So it's more like a philosophical term. This is God. You worship God. And the reason is, and you'll see what all the commentators say, the reason is that, and when they say worship God, it's going to mean worshiping particular expressions of God. Because what they say is that the divine appears in two ways. It's called vacya and vachaka. Vacya is the object and vachaka is the expression of the object. So the vacya, the object, is Ishvara. That's the form, that's the object. And the vachaka would be Om. In this case, they'll say. But they say it's non-different. The name of God, God being, or the divine being absolute, is non-different from God. So by meditating on mantras or names of the divine, that's how, with devotion, with some kind of respect, some mood of service or longing, that's what it meant by worshiping God. Most yogis inevitably had a personal sense of God and a name of God which they focused on. That's, you know. And what's going to be said here, now the, basically what happens is, it's mentioned Ishvara Pranidhan. It's mentioned three times in the Yoga Sutras. It's mentioned here as an option for meditation. It's mentioned in the second chapter where it says, what are those who aren't controlled, as obligatory practice. It's one of the three obligatory practices, including austerity, self-study, and worship of God. And there it would be more action-oriented than as an object of meditation, but in your life, like that. And then in the, I forgot where else it is, but it's a little bit later, when they mention niyams, now, because I know actually this is maybe new to some of you, but it's going to mention different processes for the practice of yoga. And three processes are going to be mentioned. One is abhyas and vairagya, which means we discussed that practice, that kind of object, meditational practice, and dispassion, that kind of detachment that comes from knowledge and understanding. That's mentioned, we just discovered that. Then in the beginning of the second chapter, which begins, it's going to mention Kriya Yoga, the yoga of action. And one of the things is Ishvara Pranidhan. And then when it mentions the niyams, basically in the, that, no, then there's, okay, then there's Astanga Yoga, which is an eight process path that's progressive, where first you yam. There are activities, we're going to discuss them tomorrow, very relevant, like nonviolence and truthfulness, how you control the mind in relationship to others. Then there's niyam, how you control the mind in relationship to yourself, like cleanliness and celibacy and these type of things. Then, of course, there's asana, how you sit and make the body comfortable. Then pranayam, purifying the mind by breath. Then pratyahara, detaching your mind from the sense objects, then dharana, dhyan, samadhi, increasing levels of meditation. When it mentions the niyams, it mentions, and the yams, it mentions the benefit you get for protecting them, for perfecting them. You'll get a benefit from, we'll read about that, it's kind of interesting. You know, if you perfect truthfulness, you know, you get great power. Because when you have absolute integrity, then somehow or other, people will follow you. You know, if you're free from covetousness, greed, you know, then there's benefits. If ahimsa, you perfect ahimsa, no one will be, some, you know, you can know your past lives, there's different ones. When it comes to the niyam, which is obligatory, in Ashtanga Yoga, one of the niyams is Ishvara Pranidhan. You have to do it. And when it comes to that one, it says the benefit for it is samadhi. So, in other words, if you can perfect that, you get the result of all this meditational processes. So the question is asked, you know, if you can choose as an object of meditation anything, right? And one object of meditation, the result of meditating on it is the perfection of meditation, which is called samadhi. None of the other yams or niyams, they all give prakritic or material benefits. If the result, then which object do you choose? Because you not only get the ability to focus your mind, but you get a reciprocation from that object that allows you to achieve something beyond your own effort, which most yogis feel that if I'm going to achieve perfection, I'm going to need some grace to help me overcome the obstacles. So this is what I read. These are what the commentaries say. When I read this, my mind was blown. Wait a second. Here it says, I'll read it. Okay. Etymologically, pranidhana means to place oneself down, prostrate, submit. And while not a common term, means devotional submission. Devotion, according to Vyas, involves a particular type of devotion. He says, simply by the yogi's longing, God bestows his grace upon the yogi. When this happens, the fruits of samadhi become quickly available. Now, I'm not asking you to believe in God or not believe in God, but I'm saying what the Yoga Sutras say. As Ramananda Saraswati puts it, God turns towards the yogi as a result of such devotion and says, let this that he desires be his. You see, I'll go a little bit, but what happens is when you chant Om, which is the Vachaka, the expression of Ishvara, then what happens is devotional feelings start to pervade your consciousness, and then you start to see the world in that way. And when that spirit is there, it causes a reciprocation in this tradition from the divine. Because it's personal. And personal means what? Reciprocation. If someone is impersonal, it's very unpleasing, isn't it? You ever met someone where you give your heart out, you love them, you surrender, is it? And nothing comes? What do you think of that person? So this conception of the divine is very personal. When you love, when you develop that love, then there's a reciprocation. What can I do for you? And it enables you to achieve beyond your effort. That's called mercy. Mercy means you have an endeavor, right? You have an endeavor, and the endeavor can pay for something, right? I work 3 hours, and I'm getting whatever money, right? But let's say that you're working, and you work, and your endeavor is worth 300, and then your boss gives you $5,000. Say, here's a little bonus. What would you think? Merciful. Gave me more than I deserved. So perfection in yoga, the conception has, somehow you got to get more than you deserve. And this is an object. Shankara states that this sutra describes bhakti, the yoga of devotion, where the Lord reaches out to the yogi who is fully devoted to him, indeed, comes face to face with him, and bestows his grace upon him in accordance with how the yogi is meditated upon him. Vigyan Bhikshu states that by meditating on the Lord with love, the yogi earns the Lord's favor. Consequently, the best path of devotion for this Vigyan, this is one of the commentators, is the best means of attaining Samprata Samadhi, since it does not require one to be solely dependent on one's own steam and resources in the intense application noted in the previous sutras. So, it's optional here, but the arguments are, why not choose this option? Because it's not just a prop. It's a person that can reciprocate with your efforts. That's why in the Gita, at the end of mentioning all yogas, it says, Yoginam api sarvesham madgate nataratmanam shradhavam bhajate yo mam saveyuk. Of all yogis, one who worships me with faith and devotion is the highest of all. It says, from the first context, we learn that the highest samadhi can be attained by dedication to Ishvara. That's in meditation. A claim which Patanjali repeats in the third section. So he says, Ishvara pranidhava. Or, if you want to achieve the samadhi, you can worship God. And then he says, if you do the niyam, the self-practice of worshiping God, the result is samadhi. This suggests that Ishvara, that's God, has the power, absolute power, to manipulate the laws of nature, to circumvent the normal procedures required for practitioners to fix their mind by removing the obstacles to yoga and somehow to pluck the devoted yogi from his or her material embeddedness simply by an act of grace. Thus we conclude that Patanjali is definitely promoting a degree of theistic practice in the Yoga Sutras. Although in the first context, what we're discussing now, commencing with the present, Ishvara Pranidhan, devotional surrender to God, is optional as a means of attending Samadhi. This is on 85. Patanjali does direct 6 sutras to Ishvara, which is not insignificant given the frugality of the sutras. They're really choice with words, but he's going to give 6 verses describing Ishvara. This devotional surrender is not optional in the second context, Kriya Yoga. So it says you have to do that. It's obligatory. If you're not, at this stage of using it as an object of meditation, you have to somehow act in a devotional way in your life. Since it is likewise not optional in the third context as a niyam, which is a prerequisite for meditational yoga, how you control and deal with yourself, regulate the mind, Pantanjali seems to be requiring that all aspiring yogis be devotionally oriented in the preparatory stages to the higher goals of yoga. And although in the higher, more meditational stage of practice, they may shift the focus to other objects, they would be best advised to retain Ishvara as an object thereafter, since the special Purusha can bestow perfection of samadhi. Actually, it's going to be called as a Vishesha Purusha. There's a soul, and then there's a Vishesha Purusha. There's a special soul. And it's going to describe that special soul exactly according to how the Bhagavad Gita describes Ishvara God, and exactly as a classical description. Okay, well, now we'll go quickly. 124, the Lord is a special soul. He is this Ishvara is Vishesha Purush. Vishesha means special. He is untouched by the obstacles of yoga, karma, the fructification of karma, and subconscious. So it says, four conditions of samsara are not with Ishvara. One, the klesha, the causes or obstacles. That's the ignorance, the ego, the attachment, the aversion. Karma, the reaction to acting selfishly. There's no karma. Karma means there's no fruitive or selfish action. Vipak, the effect that they produce, the karma. And there's no vasana, clusters. It says a yogi also may be free of these things, but Ishvara has never been used for an archetypal yoga. It's only referred to Vishesha Purush God. It's not an archetypal yogi. Patanjali is referring to the classical conception of God. You can't extract the term Ishvara from the time in which it was used. So it's a Vishesha Purush. The notion in modern commentaries that Ishvara is some sort of archetypal yogi is nowhere to be found in the traditional commentarial tradition of yoga school, not for that matter in the usage of the term Ishvara in the history of Indic philosophical discourse. Sometimes you'll see that, but it's not supported. Yes, yes.
So then why are the icons like Krishna so...
What's that?
Why are the icons then, like Krishna, for instance, so heavily worshipped if there is no... Oh, you're saying archetypal. Never mind.
No, Krishna is considered Ishvara.
Right.
In other words, he's not being specific. There's different manifestations of that personal God, just like there's different manifestations of you.
Right.
You know, or someone may be a girlfriend, someone may be the daughter, someone may be the lover, someone may be the boss. So that there's different conceptions according to the revelation. They're saying because God's personal, what does personal mean? Personal means that you reveal yourself in relationship. According to love, then you give more of yourself. Just like I'm in class now, I'm getting to know a little bit about of you, and as there's a relationship, you may let me know a little bit more. But you have very intimate relationships with people, know even more. So there's different conceptions, revelations of that, but Ishvara refers to the personal God.
So then I guess what my question is that to denote an anthropomorphic figure for your god, wouldn't that, for instance, let's say I worship Ishvara through the lens of Krishna, couldn't that be arguably considered wrong knowledge and therefore a klesha?
Well, maybe, you know, you're asking a question, they actually, there's some place here that it actually deals with that. You know, is, you know, the thought of Ishvara, you know, or a particular image of God, you know, klesha or material. I'll find it for tomorrow. It comes to the conclusion that it's not. But I can see that argument there, according to the yoga school. It's not my tradition, because I, you know, my tradition. Again, what I mentioned is that there's not a complete dislocation of the soul with the thought process and the, you know, what's happening now to us. That they ascribe those type of thoughts of will. Or determine, or something. There's something there within the soul. There's not a complete dislocation, you know. So they have that kind of difference there. But in yoga, there is. So yeah, an argument can be made. So is that like just one of the kleshas or something like that? I'll find the part where they discussed it. I didn't think it was going to come up. I don't remember where it is, but I'll look at it and we'll read it tomorrow. But yeah. But even this sense is individuality. So there's already distinction when there's individuality. So they believe at least that the soul is definitely an individual. It's different from other souls. In perfection, yoga is also against the concept of the Dvaita Vedanta. That conception that's kind of popular, even though it's a minority view, is that when we become perfect, we lose our individuality. There's actually only one thing. It's a fact, everything is one. Just like if you look at my body, if you point to my hand, I can say, this is my body. If you point to my stomach, this is my body. If you point to my knee, this is my body. It's all one. But the hand is not the knee. The knee is not the stomach. So they have that concept of oneness, that everything is part of that absolute reality, but that absolute reality has inconceivable potencies and energies, including us. And there's a reason for it. So the conception, even in yoga, is in perfection you don't become one. Right? And one of the arguments they give, if in perfection, right, that in perfection you become free from illusion and you realize that you're everything, right? Then there should be no one else left because there's only one. Right? It's really hard. I mean, I can get into philosophical arguments, but I don't want to too much like promote my school. I'm just neutrally teaching text, but it comes out sometimes. But at least I let you know when it does, right? But here's the argument: if you say that individuality is an illusion, right? If you say that, right, and when you become free from that illusion, then everything is just one. There's a complete merging. If that's your conception, right? Then what is the support of illusion? Well, if you say the souls, the individual souls, are an illusion, according to that philosophy, that's also an illusion. So illusion can't be the support of illusion. So then you have to say that Brahman, or God, is an illusion. And that doesn't make sense. And then you also have two things. You have God and illusion. I mean, there's difficulties. But yoga doesn't believe that. Yoga believes when you become perfect, it just doesn't deal with what the relationship is with that Ishvara, because that's not the scope of he doesn't talk about it. Because that's not the scope of yoga. The scope of yoga is realizing the self, and what exactly that is and happens, he doesn't discuss it. Okay? Any other questions? Okay, so he says it's a special soul, and then, and by the way, Krishna Namacharya and Iyengar and Krishnamurti's son, Deshikachar, they were in a very theistic tradition, actually speaking, called Sri Vaishnavism. Okay, then it says, in him the seat of omniscience is unsurpassed. This is all. Then it says, Ishvara was the teacher of the ancients because he is not limited by time. All other teachers, you see, even if you talk about yogis, right, they're not completely omniscient, because omniscient means past, present, and future. And even Buddha and Mahavir and all these that became enlightened, it means one time they weren't enlightened. So this is a different description of some kind. It's not an archetypal yogi. It's a classical description of God. It gives it in the Yoga Sutras. I didn't go too much into it. Again, you can read that if you want. But that's what it says. Okay? That this state of samadhi can also be achieved by worshiping God. There's an element of mercy that allows you to achieve beyond your effort. And although it's an optional object of meditation, in the process of yoga, it's definitely obligatory in Ashtanga Yoga and Kriya Yoga. It's one of the things you do. Now, how do you do that? Now look at verse 127. How do you do that? So it says, Tasya Vachaka Pranava. The Vachaka, the name, the Vachaka. Vachaka means the expression of Ishvara, is the mystical syllable Om. So the Vachaka, the expression, is non different than the Vacha, what is expressed. This one supreme absolute truth has two aspects: the expression of it and that which is expressed. They're non different. So this is what, and it says Om. So Om is the expression of the divine. It's not different, and by chanting it, and they say how to do it, this is Ishvara Pranidhan. This is your surrender. You're giving your life, your air, your consciousness in this meditation. And it's kind of interesting. It works something like this. Something like this. That they're material sounds, right? They're letters that are put together. But the concept is, by the divine will, certain letters come together to become more than what they are. They become a receptacle for the divine. It's kind of like energy. If you have a refrigerator, you know, the energy can be used by, like, heat, or it can be cold. So everything is God's energy. So God can make it in a way that it becomes transformed. Another example would be like a mailbox, right? You can paint something, you know, red, white, and blue, but it won't have the mystic potency of putting a little postcard in there with a little zip code and going to the, you know, the middle of Borneo in a little village, because it's not authorized. There's certain sounds called mantras that have a certain potency, authorization, that they are able to become spiritualized. It's described like an iron ball in fire becomes fire. Right? It's heat and light. So in our tradition, the same thing. There's designated names of the divine that are non-different, and they become kind of energized by the purity of our expression of them. They become more potent by the expression of them. And then, because every vastu in Sanskrit is an object, every object has a shakti or potency to influence you according to what it's created for. God, the object of God, and acts of expression of devotion have the potency to put that love and devotion in your heart. And when you give yourself to it in that meditation and in that focus, and that devotion comes into your heart, there's a reciprocation from the object of your devotion to enable you to achieve your spiritual goals. So this is a classical presentation or meditation of it. And it's called the Pranava Mantra. And sometimes it says, it's called Pranava Mantra. Sometimes it's said Pranava, means Na means not, Pra means Prakriti, it means not of matter. And sometimes Pranava, Pra means perfectly, and Nava means praised. So it's the sound that's not only the object of the divine, but it's the perfect expression of love for the divine in the same way. And then there's some kind of reciprocation from it. And now it says, well, how do you do that? Well, how do you practice it? So it says, tajapas tadartam bhavanam. It's repetition, and the contemplation of its meaning should be performed. So you chant the mantra, and it's your object of meditation. So it's constantly within your consciousness or your mind. You're constantly dwelling on it. It says bhavanam, you're dwelling upon it constantly. So this is how you control the mind. Katha Upanishad said it's the best support. It's the best object of meditation. Reference from the Vishnu Purana, from Swadhyaya, reciting mantras, let yogi be practiced. And from yoga, let reciting mantras be performed. By perfection in both, the supreme Atman shines. And bhavanam, permeating the mind again and again. And then artha, the meaning. It says, artha, you contemplate on it, you contemplate on its meaning. And what is the meaning? The meaning is that surrender, that giving myself to something greater than myself. That it's the object of your surrender. Because we're part of something which is greater than ourselves, and the part is meant to serve what it's part of. So there's a sense of surrender and devotion in the consciousness as one is doing this. What does he say here? This is a commentary from Vigyan Bhikshu. His name is Pranava Om, And pranidhan devotion consists in contemplating him, preceded by chanting om, and culminating in direct perception of him. This absorption with regard to the Supreme Ishvara is the primary practice in asamprajnata samadhi. Wow. So some say this, rather than you're meditating on the divine, and by meditating on, it's like you see the sun, automatically you see yourself. So you can by meditating on this way, then everything else becomes revealed. Anyway, it's what you say or something like that. Whatever the case is, what's your name again? You asked that question. You're meditating deeper, and whatever material conception you have becomes purified, and you have higher and higher and deeper perceptions. But it is a personal God. So you may project some of your own material conceptions on it, but this is a spiritual mantra. And by that mantra, somehow or other, the higher and deeper conceptions of it is. And so that's what it says. Okay, are there any questions? Yes.
So if the goal is of this philosophy is samadhi,
yeah,
which is really returning to our nature.
Which is what?
If samadhi is actually aligning with our nature.
That's true, yeah.
Is there an explanation as to why we want to have this experience? What's the point of being a human to then... Why do we want this experience?
You mean the material experience?
Right. And is there in this philosophy,
generally... What's that?
I said it. And furthermore, is there another option as described in this
Another option than what?
Than a human experience, let's say. Like, could you remain in spirit, or...
Yeah, well, somehow or other, and he speaks about this here, the topics of origin are not really dealt with. They describe mostly there's reasons why, and I'll explain that. They describe mostly like something like, they give quotes like you're in a well and someone throws you a rope. You don't have to question how you got there. You're there, get out. But at the same time, because this question is asked in my tradition, when I look at it this, when you're dealing in a theistic conception, right, when you say God, right, or the divine, you're dealing with something by definition, whether you accept it or not, but theoretically, because we're talking theoretically not now, you're dealing with something that is beyond time. Because if it's subjected to time, it's not God. When I went to the university, what subject did you think I studied?
Philosophy.
Aeronautics. I was taking up space. It was a joke. I went to school in the 60s. That's what we did, basically. We closed down universities. We marched on Washington. It was such a glorious time. Can you imagine going to school and then all of a sudden in April you close down the school? I studied philosophy. It's true. I have a BA in philosophy. I was also taking up space, but I got a BA in philosophy. And, we went into the class, and what was the definition of God? That being of which no greater can be conceived. That's what God means. It's something that's beyond time. right? So, how to understand origins in relationship to something that's beyond time. And if you look at it this way, in just one sense, God means reality. In Sanskrit, they sometimes say advayam gyan, consciousness, which nothing is outside of. Right? So ultimately, everything is part of that reality or consciousness. But the interesting thing is, as I thought about this, how inconceivable that is. Because can you conceive of a reality that was never ending and always was? Put your mind to that. Go back and go back and go back and go back. And why? But can you understand the reality that started at a particular time and there was nothing that existed before? That also doesn't make sense. So generally they don't get into origins so much. But in the bhakti tradition, which I'm from, somehow or other it's described like this, that the ultimate reality is love. Rasa vaisaha. The ultimate, this is in my tradition, the ultimate consciousness is called rasa. Rasa is an overwhelming experience of what? Devotion, love. Love for what? Love for everything. Love for God, which is inclusive of everything else. And when you become perfected, you're overwhelmed by that. Love requires volition or will. So part of perfection is volition or will, and volition or will entitles choice, and choice can be misused. So somehow or other, when the pure soul, at least in my tradition, which is consciousness, which achieves its fruition in love, somehow or other doesn't want to be what it is, which is a devotee, a servant, a part of God, when you don't want to be what you are, it can only be fulfilled in illusion. Illusion has two aspects, not to see what's there and to see what's not there. Like if I don't see you, I'm an illusion because you're there. I'm not seeing what's there. But if a big pink elephant is next to me, I'm also an illusion. Because I'm seeing something that's not there. So either it's two sides of illusion. Either you're not seeing what's there, or you're seeing something that's not there. So somehow or other it describes when you desire not to be what you are, and you want to be, rather than, in Sanskrit there's a term, Anga and Angi. It's very good. Angi means the limbs. Anga means the limbs. Angi means the possessor of limbs. So in our conception, and I'm described, the Angi is the divine, and we're the Anga, we're the limbs. The limbs are meant to serve the part, right? So that's our when you serve, like the hand is part of the body, when it serves the body, it has meaning. Right? It has meaning. When the hand serves the body, it has meaning. It also gets nourishing and replenishment. It's also humble, because what does humble mean? Humble means to accept the will of something greater than yourself. It can be a strong hand. It can be a dexterous hand. It can be a beautiful hand. It's still a humble hand. So let's say the hand doesn't want to be the hand, but it wants to be the body. It has to, first of all, not see that it's a hand, which is an illusion, and it has to see that it's the body, which is an illusion. So somehow or other, in our tradition, the connection is something like this. If you don't want to be what you are, which is a part of something greater, the first illusion is you don't see what you are and you see something else. That's achieved by this reflection of consciousness on matter and spirit. That it's satisfying your desire to not be what you are, which is a devotee of God, and to satisfy your desire to be something you're not, which is God. So it's the illusion that, you know, your little world. So that's kind of the origin in this. It says what? You don't want to be what you are. You're given choice, so you make the choice.
I have a follow-up question.
Yeah.
Is the illusion necessary to understand the truth, or can someone be born into a tradition and already know? Because I think my perception is that we're sort of born into the illusion is supported pretty much throughout our whole lives until at some point we decide we want the truth. And so my question is, do you need to have some experience of that illusion or contrast before you can understand that?
You know, it would be something like this. I can only give you analogies. You know, someone's the son of a rich man, but he wants to be free and he doesn't want to do that. So the father says, okay, go out. Right? And then he experiences his independence and he's frustrated and then he wants to be what he is. So it's all kind of connected. Yes, sometimes satisfying our desires when they won't satisfy us will bring us to the right point. So sometimes even a father does that. Do what you want. With the wisdom, understanding that what you're doing won't satisfy you. And it doesn't. Actually, it all leads to fear and illusion and anxiety. When you think you're the center and see other things as the object for your desire, and therefore try to control the world in that way, you're frustrated because that's not what you are. And not only that, you can't even do it because the world doesn't move according to our desires. It moves according to something greater than our desire. So there's a certain sense of frustration, yes. Yeah, you know, something like that. These are all, I mean, this goes a little bit beyond the scope of the book, but it's kind of connected in a way. But the main point is that there's a recommendation here for meditation and how it's done. And it gives so many verses to it, which is 6, which is a huge amount, because no other object of meditation is actually described in more than one verse. And then it describes what Ishvara is, what God is, etc. So sometimes that happens, right? I think Okay. You know what I'd like to do? Any more questions? Because I still have a precious half hour. Any more? I have something I'm going to do after this. Somehow or other, I plan to cover the whole first book. And I didn't get stuck in just one verse. I didn't end too early. It's all God's grace. I don't know how it happened. Okay? I'll put my mind in the bag. Okay? Okay, so what we're going to do now is we're going to practice. There's one other point here that I should mention. Is Ishvara is a very specific name, a generic name for God. There's more specific things, more intimate names. And different yogis will choose different names of that same object and have different relationships to experience a more intimate side. I may even find where that's said. It's a very beautiful thing, so I think I should read it. It's here someplace. This is nice. Quote, according to the yogic tradition, it was this route to Ishvara that was chosen by the majority of yogis as their path to release. If I can find that part. Okay, anyway, we'll do it. Okay? So, anyway, they made a point there that it wasn't just Om. Different yogis have different names of God. So, let's end with some meditation, and I'll just share it my own personal meditation, and we'll do it with Jim. Rati, you play, or Adama, you play cartels? Okay, Rati, just very quietly. Okay, very, very, very softly. You can sit over there. Okay, I'm going to lead you through meditation, and and I make accompany it, this is another thing, accompanied a little bit by music, which is rag, melody, and tal. Tal is rhythm, rag is melody. And that rag and tal, they inspire the devotional sentiments, which help you to focus on the object of your meditation. But I'm going to do... Okay, so first just sit up, okay? And if you can just take a few deep breaths, and just even meditating on the breath is yoga. Now remember, when you meditate, other thoughts may come, but don't follow those other thoughts, okay? And the Ajna Chakra is right between the eyebrows. You just try to keep the mantra, only the mantra within your mind. And there's two ways to focus on something. One is because you understand you should, and one because you have a relationship with that object. I'm going to lead you in my own personal guided meditations on the Hare Krishna mantra. So... I will chant and you'll listen. So the first meditation that I give is called yogic. Hear every syllable. If you hear every syllable of the mantra, you'll get the fruit of the mantra, which is that sense of devotion, which will develop this relationship with the mantra and help you to focus on it more. Then I'll stop chanting and I'll ask you to just meditate on the mantra yourself. And then I'll give you another type of meditation. And we'll go through this. You listen, and then you chant, okay? Every syllable here. No other thoughts. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. Krishna Krishna. Hare Hare. Very softly. Yourself, keep on chanting the mantra in your mind. Let all other thoughts go. Just hear the mantra. Now the mantra is also considered Shabda Brahman. It's none different than the divine. So when I chant next, what you'll do is you'll try to feel the mantra. You try to feel the vibration throughout your body. And you'll try to feel what you feel for the mantra, and therefore feel the nature of the soul. So your meditation will be to really feel the mantra, and feel what you feel for the mantra as a vibration. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna. thoughts go. Become deeper and deeper absorbed in the object of your meditation. Now the mantra is also, as it says there, should be chanted with respect. And that means thinking of the meaning of the mantra. So the mantra means a yearning for purity of heart and service. Service to the divine, service for everything. So in this meditation that I do, is you listen to the voice of the mantra, you listen to the sincerity of your chanting. Hear every syllable, feel every syllable, and listen to the sincerity of your chanting and go deeper. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Chanting to yourself. Neglect all other thoughts. Just keep on meditating on the mantra and go deeper and deeper. And as you neglect the other thoughts, the mind will gradually morph to a higher degree of perception and peacefulness. Now the mantra is also Shakti. Shakti means energy, and energy means to please its source. So the essence of all Shakti is love, or to please. So we chant the mantra to please the mantra, to please the divine, and we offer it in love as sweetly as possible. So every syllable is chanted as sweetly as possible. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Try to live in the soul. Sometimes we can just feel some gratitude. We feel that as the budding nature of the soul. Kind of an energy to serve. And if you want, at the end of your meditation, you can just clasp your hands before your chest. It's a mudra of these hands that have been used selfishly is now for the service of others. And feel the soul and feel the love from the soul and try to distinguish that from the thoughts of ego that come from the mind. The kind of yoga is something like that. You want to live within that and really distinguish it from that. And even open our eyes, not open our eyes yet, but feel the mood of seva. And then we can gradually open our eyes and try to look through the soul, look through the lens of peacefulness, the pure mind, and look through the mood of love and service, and try to keep that consciousness. So what I'd like to do, now I'm introducing the bhakti path. In the bhakti path, there's exchanges, not just in your meditation, but in the world, called the dati grita grinati. You give gifts and you accept gifts. Guyama yachi prichati. You teach and you learn. You inquire in confidence. You explain in confidence. And you give prasad, sacred food, and you accept it. So we'll end the class. If you could all come up, I would like to give you some donuts. Okay? So if you can all come up, we'll just give them all if you want.
Thank you.